Yeah, welcome everyone. I was thinking more people would hop on, but I'm doing it differently this time. Normally, when I do Feel Without Fear, the workshops are always like in the evening and the group calls are always in the morning. And this time, just to make it more accessible for people overseas, because I actually think I have more people in this cohort in Europe than I do in America, which is a first. So, for that reason, we decided to change up the time so that it was more accessible for more people to have it at different times, especially for those of you overseas. And yeah, I wonder if like our people in the States, like, it's the middle of the morning here and they're like at work or at school or doing stuff with kids or whatever. And those of you in Europe, it's like the end of your day and you're like home and off work and stuff. So that may be why we have lower attendance, but that's okay. That's why we have replays. All right. Any questions before we get started? Is anyone not caught up on replays or have a question about a past workshop or group call before we get started? I just want to give you a chance to check in.
I actually have a quick question.
Yeah.
I think a couple of us were confused with the timing in our group message. We were all like, what, when is it? What time is it? And I know I had it on my calendar. Like I had something on my calendar for like last week, and I think I missed that there was a shift in the time. So I don't know. It's been
Yeah. I don't know. David, should I tell them about our Zoom calendar scheduling fiasco, or would you like to go for it? Okay. So like, I don't know, 3 months ago, maybe 2.5 months ago, Zoom did this big update. And so I updated it. And ever since they did that update, like the scheduling has been a nightmare. Like, I don't even know how to tell you. I've had even my one-on-ones have been like, I know we scheduled a session for this day, but I never got the link, or the link says this time, but I know we said this time. Or like, I would go on my calendar and the call wouldn't be on the calendar, but then I would open Zoom and it would be on the Zoom schedule, but it wasn't on my calendar schedule. So it was like, even though the two were synced, like, even though my Google Calendar and my Zoom account are totally connected, it wasn't. And like, we did a whole, David emailed Zoom customer support and was like, we're losing meetings. Like, meetings are falling off the calendar even after they're scheduled. It has been a nightmare. It has been a nightmare. So
right. I
yes,
just
we
want to make sure
also
we're
had,
not like nobody's missing anything or we're like
nope.
kind of on the same page.
Yeah, no, you're not missing anything. If anything, I've told David multiple times, I'm like, this makes me feel like so unprofessional that like, I know we had these calls scheduled for a different date and time. Like, I know we did, but then they weren't on the calendar, but then they were on the website. But then I was like, because they were on the website, but not on the calendar, then I scheduled one-on-ones during the time when the workshops were supposed to be, because it wasn't on the calendar. So to me, it looked like a free open space. So then it was like, shit, now I've scheduled a one-on-one in a place where there was supposed to be a workshop or a group call, because I should have gone to the website instead of just looking at, I trusted my calendar, right? Like, sorry for trusting the calendar. But anyway, it has been a fiasco. I think after some back and forth with Zoom and then like resetting, reconnecting my Zoom account and the calendar, I think we have it figured out, but I'm so sorry. Like, you're not wrong in your confusion.
Technology, it happens. It's okay.
Oh, it's just been
Lindsay,
a
do you by any chance have just the dates? Because similar to the rest of the ladies, because I got an email yesterday, which would have been the 24th, to say that the next call was on the 19th, which obviously wouldn't be the 19th because
I
we were
had that
past the
same thing
19th.
too.
And then it said 3 p.m. But so I understood then that we were meeting maybe today at which would have been 9 p.m. my time, which is like I don't really mind what the times are, but I'm just really lucky I'm in a work that I could leave early today because I literally found out half an hour ago it was on now. So I was like racing home. I was like to work. I was like, I'm out of here. But I'm lucky that I can do that. So I also wonder, is that why there might have been lower attendance? Because I wouldn't be able to
Yeah.
go last minute only for the job that I'm in.
That's
So I
possible.
It's possible, but I was just gonna like just look at tech gremlins. Exactly. I know
Yeah.
all about it. So this is just what happens. But if like, is there, when is the next one after today? If I even knew that much, that would make me happy.
Okay, David just posted the schedule in the comments. So the next group call is next Wednesday, a week from today, on October 2nd at 12 p.m. Central. So that should be like I don't know, 6 or 7 p.m. for you, something like that. And then the next workshop is October 10th, which is a Thursday at 5 p.m. Central, which might be late for those of you in Europe. Yeah, David, do you have in the back end of their membership, do you have those correct dates? They're there. And I don't know why you would have gotten an email, because I get all of the emails too. And I didn't get an email yesterday that we had a call on the 19th. Like, I just checked my email and there's nothing in there. So I don't know.
Yes. Everything is available on the website. So like whenever you log in and you go to my content and then Feel Without Fear cohort 4, if you click on the start here program details button or link, that's the link that I just shared in the chat that shows all of the dates and the times. Everything is correct there. Yeah, the email confusion, all of the different things, like that was all because of what was going on with the calendar issues, and everything was backwards and wrong and weird. And I was confused. Lindsay was confused. Zoom
we were
was confused.
Fighting. We were fighting with each other.
Yeah. And so we were trying to figure out, okay, how do we sort this out the best way we can and then communicate the correct information? Well, here we are. So, but yes, yeah. On the website, everything is exactly as I just posted in the chat. So you should see everything there that you need. So if you have any other questions in the meantime, or get confused or whatever, just shoot me an email and we'll get you sorted out.
I think, David, we should also just send out an email and just like tell everyone in the cohort about the confusion and the Zoom issue and clarify and apologize and tell them how we thought about it and everything else. Okay, good. He will do that. Yeah, y'all, I'm really sorry. We've also been extremely, extremely frustrated. And I just wish Zoom would have never updated. Everything was fine the way it was. It was all fine. My world was fine. And I felt like I had to learn to reuse it. And yeah, I will tell you something that throws, like something that triggers the fuck out of me is like tech issues. Like things I cannot control that don't work the way they're supposed to. I mean, I think every single time David has to fix something, I'm like, I don't understand the point of technology. It never works how you want it to the first time. Never. Like, I just get so heated about it. And David, of course, is Mr. like even keel. And he's like, did you try turning it off and on again? You know? And I'm just like, fuck you.
Well, yeah. And we got even to the point where it was like, okay, well, maybe we just ditch Zoom and go with Google Meetings.
Because yeah, we were thinking Google about meetings. Not even using Zoom anymore. It was crazy. Yeah. But then I was like, I don't want to relearn to use another thing. I just want to use Zoom. Anyway, you guys. All right. I'm glad we sorted that out. I'm going to release my technology trigger. Okay. That's gone. Yes, it's always the printer, Kimberly. Don't even get us started on the printer. Do you guys follow Julie's story on Instagram? She's hilarious, but she makes these videos where she's like, she's impersonating like a character, but she has a printer character. So she wears these like heart-shaped rhinestone glasses and has like red lipstick on, and her hair is kind of like this. And the printer is like chewing gum. And so then she's like, okay, I just need you to print. And the printer's like, I can't. I'm out of magenta. And she's like, it's a black and white document. You don't need magenta. Just print. And the printer's like, there's a paper jam. And she's like, there's no paper jam. Just print. And the printer's like, can't find the network. Like, it's so funny. Julie Story, that's her name. She's hilarious. Yeah, see, even David, he's been in IT for 15 years and he can tell you that printers are the worst. Like, that was his most annoying thing that he ever had to fix working in IT was people's printers. And it's probably his most annoying thing he has to fix for me, because every once in a while we have to print stuff out and it never works off of my computer the first time ever. Why don't you create a printer software that actually does what it's supposed to, babe? And then I can retire. About that? You know how to write software, so don't act like you can't do this. All right, let's stop joking about naughty printers. And I will share. He hates printers too much. Okay, I'm gonna share my screen and we are gonna hit the road. Yes, I do want to do that. All right, everyone can see my screen. Yes, where it says, "Welcome to Overcoming Health Anxiety." Okay, perfect. Even if you don't have health anxiety, you will get something out of this workshop. If you have money anxiety, relationship anxiety, whatever anxiety, you will get something out of this. All right, so every time I promise to tell you more about myself, and this time I'm going to tell you my favorite movies and shows. So if you haven't seen these, write them down and you need to watch them as soon as possible. So my favorite movies are, anybody seen Captain Fantastic? Anybody know about Captain Fantastic? Yeah, Daniel, it's so good, isn't it? Okay, there we have another affirmative for Captain Fantastic. Professor Marston and the Wonder Woman. Anybody seen that one? Oh, it's so good. It's so good. The first Avatar. I also really like the second Avatar, but the first Avatar is so good. Anyone seen the Lonesome Dove miniseries with Robert Duvall, who plays Augustus McCrae? Oh, you must watch it. It's like an American classic. I've been watching it since I was a kid in the 90s. And then my favorite TV shows are The Office, which I think we calculated up yesterday. We've probably like rewatched the whole Office series like probably 20 times. So we are regular quoters of The Office in our house, including our kids. Like even with our kids, we're like, that's what she said. Like, and quote things. Outlander, we're rewatching Outlander right now because the new season comes out in November. And of course, The Great British Baking Show. Like, who doesn't love The Great British Baking Show? So, all right, watch those. That's your homework, is to watch those shows. All right, as you guys know, I'm not a licensed healthcare provider, so please don't substitute this for mental health care and all that stuff. And our group call is next Wednesday, October 2nd at 12 p.m. That is the final time. And then our next workshop after that is going to be on October 10th at 5. It is called Expand. It is about widening your window of tolerance. And then the group coaching call will be the following Wednesday on the 16th at 1 p.m. Central. So hopefully my Europe people might not be able to make it to the workshop, but I think you might be able to make it to the group call. All right, let's talk about health anxiety. Who has health anxiety, by the way? Who here is like anxious about symptoms and health things and all that? Yeah, Katarina. Okay, perfect. I know Ksenia too. She mentioned that in the chat. Okay, well, here we go. Even if you don't have health anxiety, just substitute whatever anxiety you have for the word health. So, relationship anxiety, money anxiety, whatever. All right. So, in the DSM, which is the like Bible of psychiatric diagnoses, health anxiety is called illness anxiety disorder. It used to be called hypochondria. I think they changed it from hypochondria because people calling other people hypochondriacs like became like way overused. So I think they changed it. But it's essentially characterized by an obsession with the idea that you might have a serious but undiagnosed medical condition, and you worry that minor symptoms indicate something serious is going on. It's a really crazy source of anxiety because the anxiety is literally dependent on your body like doing what it's supposed to do. And when it doesn't, then it's like, oh my God. Something terribly wrong, you know, something's terribly wrong with me, and I'm gonna have to spend all this money to figure out what it is. I'm gonna have to go on this long healing journey and like do all these things. So that's health anxiety. So I'm gonna show you that it's not a disorder. There's like nothing wrong with you if you have health anxiety. It is a natural unconscious reaction to nervous system dysregulation and complex PTSD, just like every other type of anxiety. It's just one way that CPTSD manifests, and all other forms of anxiety are also manifestations of complex PTSD. So isn't it interesting? I don't know what it's like over in Europe. Are they like obsessed with symptoms over in Europe? Are people like obsessed with like when you go to the doctor's office, do they make you rate your symptoms on a scale of 1 to 10? Okay, they do that. And And then do they like offer you a lot of medications to try to like mitigate your symptoms or get rid of symptoms? Okay, perfect. So isn't it interesting that a focus and fear of symptoms and sensations, right? Because we all know that sometimes the symptom is just a sensation in our body, is pathologized, diagnosed, and treated as a mental illness or a disorder. But the conventional healthcare system and like more natural, what I call wellness culture, and our society as a whole is obsessed with symptoms. So, like, there's this obsession with symptoms. There's like whole Facebook groups devoted to symptoms. There's whole Instagram accounts devoted to symptoms. There's all this focus on symptoms, but yet if you're focusing on your own symptoms in an anxious way, you have a mental illness or a disorder. Like, I just think that's so fucked up. I believe that most of our health anxiety is perpetuated and fueled by our symptom-focused culture, especially like in wellness culture. It seems that the more chronic and mysterious the issue, the better. And that guarantees that you'll get on this hamster wheel of trying to fix whatever's wrong. And you're guaranteed to spend your time and money on practitioners and supplements and health gadgets and whatever else. Or if you're not into natural stuff and you're, into like conventional medicine, that's fine. But you're also pretty much guaranteed to spend your time and money on doctor's appointments, labs, imaging, pharmaceuticals, testing, like whatever, to try to find the answer and fix the problem. Our health anxiety only benefit, it never benefits us. It only benefits corporations and companies that promise us relief or healing in exchange for money. And then if you don't get better, then you're told like you need to find something else, which requires more time or money, or you need to invest in like the next level of, of whatever. And it's outside the scope of this workshop to discuss capitalism, but I can't discount the influence that capitalism has in the healthcare industry. It is an industry, which means it's focused on turning a profit. It doesn't make money if you aren't sick. It doesn't make money if you aren't concerned about your body. It doesn't make money if you don't have health anxiety. So it profits off of you being anxious about your own body in a system that told you to focus on your symptoms. Like, do you see how meta this is and like how weird it is that we're all kind of participating in this system? Although, some of us participate more and some of us less, but yeah, it's like focus on your symptoms. There's something wrong with you. Rate your symptoms, take a pill for it, go to the doctor for it, try a supplement, do a protocol, whatever, whatever, whatever. Focus on your symptoms. Pay more money to fix your symptoms. Oh, you have anxiety about your symptoms? You have a mental illness. Like, right? Okay, so here's how I know we're obsessed with symptoms as a culture. We rate our symptoms or our pain on scales of 1 to 10. A lot of natural practitioners, naturopaths, functional doctors want you to keep a journal or a log of your symptoms and potential associations with like food or substances or medications or whatever else. There is a huge emphasis. I don't think in the US it's allowed to advertise pharmaceuticals on TV, but it is here in the US. We get pharmaceutical ads, like ads for drugs on TV, here. So there's this emphasis on like, when you're watching The Office reruns, it gets interrupted with like an ad for some crazy drug that has a longer list of side effects than it does benefits. It's great. In wellness culture, there's an emphasis on fixing symptoms with supplements and restricted healing diets, and symptoms are bad and they need to be suppressed, fixed, controlled, and gotten rid of. So of course, if you believe, because you've been conditioned by a culture to believe that your symptoms are bad, it's bad if you have symptoms, there's something wrong with you, you need to figure it out, you need to get to the root, you need to do whatever it takes. Like, instead of being like, oh, interesting, your body has a sensation. I wonder what's there, right? Like, oftentimes our symptoms are really just like chronic sensations that are indicative often of an emotional or psychosomatic issue that may not ever show up on imaging and may not ever show up on blood work. I've had that many, many times. And then, of course, we've all lived through COVID, and that forced people to be hypervigilant about their symptoms as well as hypervigilant about other people's symptoms. Before 2020, we were not always so hypervigilant about runny noses and sneezing and sore throats. And many people, like I know many people who did not have health anxiety prior to COVID, and they now have health anxiety because of COVID. They're still in this like hypervigilance about their symptoms, about other people's symptoms, about wearing masks on planes or subways. Still, like, people are still like freaked out about this because that time in our lives conditioned us to be really focused on illness and symptoms. So with all the controlling, micromanaging, fixing, suppressing, and medicating of symptoms, all the suppressing, basically, is it any wonder why our bodies are screaming at us and why we're anxious about it? Like, it makes sense. So when you're conditioned this way and you're feeling what's happening in your body through the lens of fear and anxiety and, oh my gosh, there's something wrong with me, then every new feeling or sound from your body feels threatening. Resurgences of old symptoms trigger fear that whatever the thing is back. And you want to avoid feeling in your body because what you're feeling is really scary because it's generating all of these thoughts and catastrophization and what if, and like going down the, you know, the curly slide of investigating and Googling and rabbit holes and all that kind of stuff. So believe it or not, health anxiety is not about the symptoms. I know at like on the surface, it seems like, oh, if I just didn't have the symptom, then I wouldn't have the anxiety. But that's not actually real because your health anxiety isn't about your symptoms. People often believe that if their symptoms go away, then their health anxiety will go away. And that's not the case because the symptoms are not the cause of health anxiety. Until you address the root cause of health anxiety, which is nervous system dysregulation caused by complex PTSD, you will continue to experience anxiety. And even if health anxiety is not the only kind of anxiety you experience, what I have discovered about anxiety, and I'm curious if this feels true for any of you who also have anxiety, is that anxiety is kind of like a bee or a butterfly that's just kind of hopping from flower to flower. And so like when the butterfly lands on the flower of health anxiety, you're anxious about your health. But then when the butterfly moves to the next flower, maybe that flower is the money flower and that's what you're anxious about. And then it moves again and maybe that flower is the relationship flower and that's what you're anxious about. And then it moves again and then it's like being around in social situations. And so then that's where you have anxiety. So it's like you still have anxiety. It's just, what is the anxiety focused on? What is it afraid of? And so with health anxiety, it's afraid of symptoms, but the symptom isn't the cause because you still have the anxiety. Even if the symptom goes away, it just shifts to a different thing. If it's not about your health, it'll transfer to like money, to social settings, to your business, to like whatever. Anybody noticing resistance when I say your health anxiety isn't about your symptoms and that just because you get rid of your symptoms doesn't mean your health anxiety will go away? Curious if there's anyone noticing like, but for me, it is about the symptoms. But for me, that is what I'm anxious about. It's okay. Nobody? Okay. If you had any objections in your head, like when I said your symptoms are not the cause of your health anxiety, just notice what those objections were. Like, well, you don't know me. You don't know what my anxiety is all about. Or what if my case is different? What if I'm special? But I have a real health problem. What about that? Right? Just notice those objections. So we have to talk about the voice in our head, right? Because that's where a lot of our anxiety is coming from. It's coming from the stories that we're telling ourselves in our minds, and that fuels the anxiety. So with health anxiety, the fear usually does not come from the actual sensation or the symptom itself. It usually comes from the meaning that the voice in your head makes about it. Or if you have a gut-wrenching feeling of uncertainty about what's happening in your body. Often uncertainty is also in our heads too, because the mind is like, but I don't know what's going to happen, but I don't have certainty about this, but without certainty, I can't feel safe, but how will I know? That's also like mind stories too. But of course we feel that anxiety in our bodies because our mind and body are extremely connected. So I'm curious, if you do have health anxiety, or if you have had health anxiety, if you want to tell me in the chat what your voice in your head tells you about your symptoms and sensations. I'll give you a moment to post in the chat if you would like. Ksenia says she feels very attached to her symptoms, because they prove what I went through. Yeah. No, I can't see the messages when I'm teaching. I have to like actually click on it. I think Katarina is typing, so I'm gonna give you a chance to post. Yeah. What does the voice in your head say about money or your relationship, Kimberly? If I don't do anything about it, I could die. Yep. That's real. Yeah, if you don't experience health anxiety specifically, but you have anxiety about money or your romantic relationship or your kid's health or something like that, tell me what the voice in your head says about that. Tell me what it says about money, what it says about your relationship, what it says about your body. Kimberly says, my anxiety is mostly wrapped up in money. I grew up poor and live very comfortably now, so maybe if I overspend, I could end up back there. Yeah. Sinead has anxieties about parenting. If I don't spend more time with them, I'll regret it. Yep. Danielle's anxiety tells her that she's the problem and her feelings feel overwhelming and overpowering. Yeah. Bonnie says she used to have some health anxiety, but it eased a lot after reading about neuroplastic pain. Yeah. Did you read The Way Out by Alan Gordon? Ani? Yeah, that's a good one. Nicole's anxious about relationships, that she won't find anyone who will love her in the way she wants to be loved and won't find someone who will stay through the hard times. Yeah, that's real. So real. But just notice that these are stories, right? Like, do you have any proof or evidence that they're absolutely true? Or are they just a story in your head? And is the story just rooted in like whatever your greatest fear is, right? Which everyone's greatest fear is different. So therefore, it's all relative. Thanks for sharing, y'all. I appreciate you sharing. Oh, David linked the Way Out book if anyone's interested in reading about neuroplastic pain. It's a really good book. So maybe some of the stories that you have are like just a lot of questions. Like, what if I never figure this out? What if this goes on and I get worse? What if I lose my ability to do things? What if I can't afford to fix this? What if this means I'm getting insert whatever illness you fear here, whether that's like an autoimmune illness or cancer or whatever? What if I can't take care of myself? Why won't my body just do what I need it to do? I can't live my life until this thing is gone, fixed, or better. Or maybe you have a voice in your head that's like, don't complain. Don't tell anyone what's wrong with you because people will think you're a hypochondriac. People will think you're just a complainer. If this voice in your head wasn't a fearful, critical, or shaming voice, if it was truly integrated into your whole self, here is what your self would actually say. Even though this feeling or sensation or symptom is really scary, I trust myself to feel it and seek help if and when necessary. So I just want you to notice the difference in how it might feel in your body when you're like, what if I never figure this out? What if this goes on and on and on and I never get better? Versus, even though this feeling or sensation is really scary, I trust myself to feel it and seek help if and when necessary. Like, just the energy of those two sentences, can you feel the difference? Like, one, does one feel more spacious to you? Does one feel like more urgent or more of an emergency? Even without certainty, I trust myself to feel this and to meet my needs, whatever those are. It doesn't serve a purpose to speculate and catastrophize about this. I choose to focus on love and safety instead. Like, these are all options that are available to us whenever we have anxiety, but often the story in our head is like so overpowering and creates such strong sensations in our bodies that it's difficult to access the self energy that is not actually attached to the symptom or to the relationship or to the money or to whatever else. It's just that fearful part of us who's attached to the outcome and therefore has fear about the outcome. My body is doing exactly what it needs to do, even if I don't understand what's happening. I choose to live my life to the fullest, to do what I'm capable of doing, even if this symptom is still present. right? Sometimes we collapse around the symptom and we have this story that like, oh, because I'm experiencing this, because it's so bad today, like I can't go anywhere. I can't do anything. I can't see anyone. I can't go to work. I can't do this or that. And like, certainly we often can have times where we can't go to work and we don't feel like going out. But I'm talking about with health anxiety, sometimes the symptom itself is not all that bad, but the way that you're thinking about it and the meaning that you're assigning to it makes it worse than it actually is. And so then you start limiting your life. So that fearful voice in your head is a really master storyteller, and it will take these sensations in your body and weave all kinds of stories and tall tales about them. Or the fearful voice in your head is a master storyteller about your relationship or about how you're parenting or about your finances or whatever else. And it tells you these tall tales about them that aren't actually true, but because they're scary, you focus on trying to avoid that at the expense of being able to focus on what is actually working or how your body is actually functioning or how your relationship is actually healthy or how your parenting is actually adequate. The voice in your head will convince you that you're dying, that you're on the road to disability, that you're going to lose all your joy in life. It'll tell you that you need to take these drastic steps to control and fix these situations or spend a bunch of money trying to fix it. It believes that sensations means there's always something wrong. Like the sensation can't just exist as a sensation and it be neutral. The voice says, no, this sensation is wrong. I'm not supposed to feel this. It means there's something bad happening. Or in money, oh, my bank account got down to this amount. That means there's something wrong. There's something bad happening. And maybe there's even some shaming like, oh, I shouldn't have bought that new outfit, or we shouldn't have taken that trip. It was too expensive. And now we don't have the money. And like, look what we did to ourselves, right? So there's like shaming about money, or, you know, your husband has an off day or something and seems more withdrawn than usual. And then your anxiety voice in your head is like, oh, he's mad at me. What if he wants to divorce me? You know, just like things like that. These stories are just, they're so big and they can feel so scary because we choose to believe them instead of focusing on what is actually true. And then when we don't have awareness of this voice in our head creating all of these stories, we just live in this like fear and reactivity. So people with health anxiety feel so triggered by what's happening in their bodies and their lack of control that they are constantly looking for certainty. And maybe you do this with your bank account, or maybe you do this with your relationship. Like ways that you're looking for certainty with your bank account is like, if you're constantly checking your balance, or if you're like, I can't spend money on this or this or this or this or this because it's not worth spending money on those things because then I might be poor. So with health anxiety, looking for certainty is like you're frequently checking in with your body and your symptoms, like to the point where you're like going on about your day. And then the anxiety is like, oh, and you're like, you like stop and you're like, okay, is it there? Is the symptom there? Is it better or worse than last time I felt it? Right? Like, it's like, you're just checking in with yourself all the time. Googling, making multiple doctor's appointments. Like I saw this doctor, they didn't tell me what I wanted to hear, or they didn't have an answer for me, so I'm going to go find someone else. So you're like hopping from practitioner to practitioner, having hypervigilance about new symptoms or recurrence of old symptoms. So like if an old symptom comes up, it's like the story is like, oh shit, it's back. Oh my gosh, I thought I had it fixed. What the hell? Also, you can micromanage yourself or your kids' health. This is one of the ways that my health anxiety came up, was like trying to micromanage like my kids' health. As well as my own, getting on that hamster wheel of wellness where you're like chasing symptoms and going in circles, but never actually getting anywhere. There's always a sense of urgency with health anxiety, or really with any anxiety, right? The energy of anxiety is an urgent energy. And it's like, this is so scary. I'm so worried about this that I have to hurry up and figure it out. And I have to fix it as quickly as possible. And then obviously like, you know, the Facebook support groups for mystery illnesses. If you've never had a mystery illness and you've never like gone to Facebook and joined a group, let me just encourage you to never, ever do that ever. the Facebook support groups, I found whenever I was on my own hamster wheel, joining the Facebook support groups, trying to figure out what was wrong with me and like get some kind of certainty. I found that the Facebook support groups more often than not were like places of doom and gloom. And it was like, you're going there for reassurance, or you're going there to hopefully read that someone's had some success or someone's figured it out or whatever. And more often than not, what you actually read is like, you know, well, I'm on day 378 of not being able to get out of bed, and when will this ever end? And like all of that. And it really is like, it's like, shit, what if that happens to me? Right. So then you start catastrophizing based on what other people are experiencing. That's my experience of the support groups. Like, I would never join a support group on Facebook for like an illness that I was in ever again. Like, it was that in and of itself was like extremely traumatizing for me. And it took me a while to like unfuck my brain from that kind of stuff. All right. So picture like a 5 or 6 year old kid. Maybe you want to picture yourself. Maybe if you have a child, picture them, or just picture another kid, you know, a niece and nephew, something like that. But just picture a child who feels like funny sensations in their body and doesn't know what's going on. They need a caring parent or some other trusted adult to reassure them, to let them know that they're okay, that they're taken care of, and that they're safe. Now, imagine that 5 or 6 year old kid is you. But you now, as an adult, looking for someone to reassure you, to let you know that you're okay, to let you know that you're taken care of and safe. Doesn't it seem more like a child part in you than like your adult self who's like seeking all of this? Can you discern that in your body? Can you notice like, oh yeah, it doesn't actually feel like the highest, wisest, most loving and trusting part of me. It actually feels like a child part who feels really uncertain and scared and needs reassurance and needs a parent to tell them they're okay and that they're safe. So if you want to close your eyes, we'll just do like a little bit of imagination work. Picture your inner child obsessively Googling to find answers. Like picture a 5 or 6 year old being so like concerned and worried about what's happening in their body. And there's no parent around who's like, it's okay, you're safe, we're going to figure this out. So the 5 year old inner child is now taking on the responsibility of figuring it out. The child is so scared of their body that they're constantly checking in with their body. They're even interrupting their playtime to check in with their body. So they're never fully present in life the way that children generally are. They're pausing what they're doing and checking in, or even if they're continuing to do what they're doing, they're not fully there because part of them is there, but part of them is still checking in. Imagine this like child trying to make doctor's appointments on their own and trying to micromanage their bodies, having this sense of doom and urgency. Imagine this 5 or 6 year old child joining Facebook support groups and following multiple Instagram accounts because they're just needing help and certainty and answers. Do you feel sadness in your body? Do you feel like you want to like take this child into your arms and be like, hey, let me take care of you. Let me help you with this. You're too little for this. What do you feel for that little child inside of you? And again, if you don't have health anxiety, apply it to any other kind of anxiety. When you think about your relationship, imagine your inner child like obsessively Googling to try to find out some certainty about your relationship, or looking at other Instagram accounts about couples trying to find some kind of certainty that you're supposed to be with your partner or that everything's going to work out. What do you feel for that little kid inside of you? Katarina says she feels overwhelmed. Yeah. Anyone else? Ani got goosebumps on her arms and then shuddered and then felt sad. Ksenia felt sad. Yeah, it is sad because that little kid is you. And it's important for us as adults to connect with that inner child and realize, like, with health anxiety or relationship anxiety or any kind of anxiety, there's like a kid on your bus. Like, this is a part of you. And when you have this anxiety, it hijacks the bus from the higher self as the bus driver. So it doesn't matter if it's about your health or your parenting or your finances or your relationship or, you know, fitting in socially or whatever. It doesn't matter what you have anxiety about. the part of you that has anxiety is this little child who's like, I feel so unsafe and uncertain, and I like don't know what to do. So I'm just going to start doing all of this crazy stuff to try to feel better. It is really sad and overwhelming. Now let's link health anxiety and complex PTSD together in case any of you were like, it feels kind of like a stretch to call health anxiety a manifestation of complex PTSD. But my opinion is that all anxiety is a manifestation of complex PTSD. So back to our very first workshop, we'll just review some things. Complex PTSD usually, but not always, forms in childhood. It's the water we were swimming in. It's the environment we were in. We may not have even noticed that anything was wrong at the time. We may have thought it was extremely normal, because how would you know that something else exists if you've never experienced living in a different family or you've never experienced different parents, right? What you have experienced is what is your reality. In childhood, children don't have the cognitive and developmental ability to understand that when our caregivers can't or won't attune to our needs and co-regulate with us, that that isn't our fault. So a huge piece of complex PTSD is that the parents are absent, or the parents are abandoning or neglectful or abusive or just not there or whatever. And the child is like, there must be something wrong with me. I'm the reason why. If I could just be more perfect, if I could just be more obedient, if I could just be more compliant, if I could just be prettier, thinner, more popular, make better grades, like whatever, then maybe my parent will be able to attune to me and co-regulate with me. And then, yeah, there's deep core beliefs that there's something wrong with us. We can also have complex PTSD alongside adverse childhood experiences. Has anyone not taken their ACEs test? Does everyone know what your ACEs score is? Okay, David, will you put the link for the adverse childhood experiences test in the chat? It's just 10 questions. They're yes or no answers. It's asking about things that you experienced before the age of 18. I always ask my one-on-ones to do this, or I do it with them. My ACEs score is a 6, or it's a 7. I don't know if I was sexually abused or not, but it might be a 7 if I was. Otherwise, it's a 6. And that's important to know, like, not because it has to mean anything, but it's just really valuable information about yourself. The studies around adverse childhood experiences are long-term studies that show that kids with higher ACEs scores tend to have poorer health outcomes later in life. So they're statistically more likely to suffer from like obesity, heart disease, and other metabolic illnesses. They're statistically more likely to like use substances or have addictions. They're statistically more likely to have mental illness, to get divorced, like things like that. So these experiences in our childhoods, and ACEs experiences are like big T traumas. Like these are like witnessing violence, witnessing substance abuse, a family member attempting suicide, witnessing like your dad laying hands on your mom or laying hands on you in a physical way. So they're big T traumas, but a lot of complex PTSD is a bunch of little T traumas. I can't remember who it is, but someone calls complex PTSD death by 1,000 paper cuts, because it's like nothing huge happened. Like you didn't witness, you know, your dad overdose on heroin or something. You didn't witness physical violence in your home, but you were constantly on the receiving end of a critical parent's, you know, constantly raising the bar, which caused you to like develop the adaptation of perfectionism, or you're constantly on the receiving end of, like for me, the silent treatment. Right. And so then I developed this like very anxious, pursuing kind of mood or attitude with my mom. And then when that didn't work, then I was like people pleasing and cleaning and like trying to do things that would make her happy. You know, the silent treatment is not a big T trauma. Like that's not the same thing as being in a natural disaster or your house burning down or something like that. But when you experience that silent treatment enough as a child, you form a complex about it. You form this belief that like, I don't know why, but I must be doing something really bad for my parent to not be able to attune to me and make eye contact with me and talk to me, even when I'm basically begging her to do so. And so then I have to earn her love and attention and attunement back. And now I'm doing all of these things to try to earn that back. Like, that's not a big T trauma. That's a little T trauma. And yet that's where the majority of like my issues in my adult life come from. It's not from, you know, having experienced physical violence, which I did. It's not from having experienced, you know, a natural disaster or a war or something like that. It's from all these little times that my mom gave me the silent treatment and just completely sucked her love and attention and affection away from me. When we have complex PTSD, we often have hypervigilant about our environments or our other people's communication cues. So we can often be very sensitive to facial expressions, body language, tones of voice, the way someone is breathing, if they sigh, if they roll their eyes, or if we think they rolled their eyes, like things like that can be really triggering to us. The nervous system state in complex PTSD is often like a chronic fight flight state, but it's also often like an immobilized fawn appease state. And it can go back and forth, but it is often an immobilized state because by the time you get to adulthood, you're so fucking exhausted from like this lifetime of trying to please everyone that you don't have a lot of resources left. Very common with complex PTSD to second guess, doubt, even gaslight yourself. And complex PTSD can often feel like really nebulous and cloudy. Like you can't quite identify like what's going on. It's like, okay, do I have OCD? Do I have ADHD? Do I have abandonment issues? Am I a perfectionist? It's kind of like all over the place. That's how you know it's complex PTSD, because it's really complex. So remember our friend Pete Walker from our complex PTSD book. Hopefully everyone has this by now. If you don't, please get it. He says that complex PTSD is a learned set of responses and a failure to complete numerous important developmental tasks. This means that it is environmentally, not genetically caused. It is neither inborn nor characterological, and as such, it is learned. It is not inscribed in your DNA. It is a disorder caused by nurture, or rather a lack of it, not nature. What is learned can be unlearned and vice versa. What was not provided by your parents can now be provided by yourself and others. So there is hope for those of us with complex PTSD. What I have discovered is that complex PTSD healing is a lifelong commitment to going deeper and deeper into the things that trigger me, facing them, feeling them, and then coming out knowing on the other side, like who I am and what I want, and embodying my most authentic self, and then lather, rinse, repeat, lather, rinse, repeat. So some complex PTSD symptoms that are also common characteristics of health anxiety. So I want to like the ones that are asterisked are also things that we experience with health anxiety. So I want you to notice how close those are. Emotional flashbacks, a tyrannical inner critic, toxic shame, self-abandonment, anxiety, feeling lonely and abandoned, hypervigilance, catastrophization, fragile self-esteem, developmental arrest, relationship difficulties. We could put that on there if you have relationship anxiety. Dissociating, oversensitivity and intolerance to stress, perfectionism, mood swings, negative noticing, control, suicidal ideation. I should asterisk the suicidal ideation one because I actually was ideating suicide because of a health issue. Because to me, it felt so big and so overwhelming and so scary. And on top of it, I also wasn't sleeping. I didn't see any way out of that. And I, you know, actually attempted to end my life because of it. So I should probably correct that slide. As you guys know, I'm not a huge fan of labels and like living your life as a label of something, because we know CPTSD is not genetic. It's learned. We can unlearn it. We each have a sovereign responsibility to ourselves to use our agency and become aware of these patterns, the behaviors, the triggers, and the beliefs, and unlearn them, decondition from them, reprogram ourselves. When I use the term complex PTSD, it is not an attempt to identify with a diagnosis or to feel like a victim or to get some kind of special treatment or accommodations or something like that. It's just language that succinctly describes a collection of beliefs, nervous system states, emotional states, and behavioral patterns that stem from emotional abandonment and neglect. It's much easier to just be like, yeah, I've got complex PTSD, than it is to list out like anxiety, hypervigilance, abandonment wounds, you know, like all of that kind of stuff. It's just easier for me to say complex PTSD. We know that complex PTSD is different from post-traumatic stress disorder in two main ways. First, complex PTSD is not a one and done kind of thing. Like if you were in the military and your unit was bombed, like that's a one and done thing, right? It's a thing that happens once, or maybe it's a series of bombings or shooting or something like that, but eventually it ends. And if you didn't die, then you go back to you know, your unit or your base or whatever. And like, yeah, maybe you have nightmares, maybe you can't sleep, maybe the sound of fireworks like makes you startle a lot. Things like that. That's post-traumatic stress disorder. Complex PTSD forms over months or years. And that's why it's possible to have complex PTSD, even from a long-term adult relationship, like a marriage or a long-term partnership. Like David and I totally have some complex PTSD from each other. Like totally we do. And that I'm not ashamed of that. Like that just happens because we weren't aware and awake for most of our relationship. Like we've been together for 23 years. We've only been like what I would say is like awake and aware for like the past 7 years, you know? So we have what is that? Like 15, 16 years of history where we were not aware, we were not embodying our higher selves. We had no idea what our nervous systems were. We had no idea what complex PTSD was. So yeah, some of the patterns that David and I found ourselves in are things that we've had to like go back and unlearn and discuss and heal just from our relationship with each other that doesn't even involve our childhoods. And then the second thing about complex PTSD is it's always relational. It usually, but not always, forms in childhood, but it can also form in a long-term intimate relationship, like I said, and it can form in relationship to yourself. So there's not always a relational aspect to post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, unless of course, like your father, like beat the shit out of you or beat the shit out of your mom and you witnessed it. Like that is enough to cause PTSD, obviously. But yeah, so hopefully we understand the difference of those. Complex PTSD is a little sneakier. It's a little less obvious sometimes. It often gets misdiagnosed as other things. So then you never actually realize that what you're dealing with is complex PTSD. All right, let's take a look at this list of punishing parents. So you can use your hand and actually raise your hand, or you can use the like hand raise reaction button on your Zoom thing. But just tell me, I'm going to go through each one of these and I want you to raise your hand if you experienced this with your parents. Did they take things away from you when you misbehaved? Toys, food. Okay. Toys, food. They grounded you, took away playtime, things like that. Okay. Nicole, Katarina, Carrie, Kim, Danielle. Okay. So most of you. Did they isolate you by sending you to your room or locking you in your room? Okay. Most of you. Did they expect perfection, whether that was your grades, your behavior? Did they punish you if you made mistakes, which were just normal childhood things? Yeah, Carrie, Danielle, Kim, Katarina. Okay. Did your parents try to control you through punishment? Ksenia, Carrie, Danielle. Okay. Did they withdraw their loving presence from you if you were bad? Wow. Everyone's hand went up. Okay. We all know that's emotional abandonment, right? Okay. Did they make you feel shame or guilt when you were bad? Okay. Most of you. Did they force you to earn their love back, either through actually doing things for them or emotional labor to earn their love back? Okay. All right. Okay, deep breath. Get ready for this. Who takes away things from yourself when you're bad? Danielle's like, okay, there's no shame. Who self-isolates? Who expects perfection from your body, or you punish yourself or your body when it misbehaves? Mm-hmm. Who attempts to control their body or force it to heal? Who withdraws their own loving presence from ourselves when our body is bad? Who feels shame whenever you're controlling and forcing and fixing don't work? Who feels guilt for how your health or your anxiety is a burden to other people? Who feels guilt when you indulge and you call it cheating? Or when you don't follow the restrictive healing diet perfectly, you're cheating. Okay. Are we just mind blown for a second? Do we see the similarities? Do we see how we learn to treat ourselves from how our parents treated us? So, perfectionism, flashbacks, looks like all or nothing, black and white thinking. Self-hate or shame. I've done all this and I'm still not fixed. Micromanaging, worrying, obsessing, thought looping, projecting into the future. Unfairly comparing yourself or your body to a past version of yourself or to other people. Guilt for how you feel, if you eat or drink something bad, if you're cheating. Shoulding all over yourself. I should eat this. I should take that. I should do this. I should do this workout program. I shouldn't eat that. I shouldn't drink that. Lots of shoulding on ourselves. Harshly judging ourself and our body. Drasticizing, catastrophizing, and blowing symptoms out of proportion. Negatively focusing on things. Sense of urgency with time. Procrastinating. A victim consciousness. Why me? Of course, this happens to me. Nothing ever goes my way. My body never behaves like I need it to. A belief that you've done something wrong to deserve your symptoms. For a really long time, any new thing that I had, like even when I got COVID, if I had a stomach bug, if I had like a cycle with more cramps than usual, even, I had this like immediate voice in my head that was like, what did I do to cause this? Like, immediately, what did I do to cause this? Like, you got COVID, bitch. You didn't do anything to cause it. Like, calm down, right? Like, but really, I mean, only recently, like this year, did I have a health thing. Like, I got diagnosed with hypothyroidism. I'm on thyroid medication now. It's amazing. Like, it's the first time ever in my health that something has been wrong. And as soon as I heard the doctor say, yeah, you have a thyroid problem, like, I didn't think, I wonder what I did to cause this. Shit, what did I do wrong? I wonder if I need to change how I'm eating. I wonder if it's the food's fault. Oh, I knew I should have done that restrictive diet earlier this year. I knew it. Like, it's the first time I didn't do that. I was just like relieved. I was like, oh my God, thank you. You're validating my symptoms. Like, thank you. Thyroid medication, done. Lindsay's down 20 pounds, man. Like, done. Like, felt so good. To not be like, what did I do to cause this? You know, like, so I'm like, okay, I don't know that I have as bad of health anxiety anymore. I think we're actually making progress. And I also don't think I'm putting these standards of perfection on my body anymore. It's like, oh, we have a thyroid problem. Let's address it. Let's not try to like solve it with restrictive healing diets and all that kind of shit. Let's hit the easy button. Let's do the medication route. That's great. Like, it was easy for me to make that choice. And when I had health anxiety, taking the thyroid medication instead of like embarking on a journey to like use diet and supplements to heal my thyroid naturally would have never been possible for me because then it wasn't perfect. Right? If I healed it with diet and natural things, then I did it perfectly. But if I feel better with medication, that's too easy. That's not allowed. Because that's not really healing it. That's not perfect. This is how fucking sneaky my voice in my head is. But yeah, I didn't feel that way this time. It was awesome. Now we're going to talk about dissociation. Yay. Okay. In complex PTSD, Pete talks to us about two different types of dissociation. We have left brain dissociation and right brain dissociation. So see what you identify with. Maybe you identify with both. That's fine. So left brain dissociation is like the fight flight dissociation. I know we mostly think of dissociation as like a manifestation of freezing or collapsing, but this is like a fight flight anxiety kind of dissociating. So you're swinging between obsessive compulsive doing and then worrying and planning about what you're doing, whether this is with your health or not. You're like a human doing instead of human being. You're constantly thinking, doom Googling, scrolling to distract yourself from the underlying pain or to plan what to do next, especially if you have health anxiety. You're trying to stay one step ahead all the time. You may have obsessive compulsive disorder, which is a manifestation of a flight response, like a over the top flight response. You're stuck in your head with like overanalyzing and overthinking. You might self-medicate with busyness. So like actually making doctor's appointments and Googling and trying different protocols and doing research about your health feels like a medication almost. It's like, oh, this makes me feel better when I do this because it gives me some sense of certainty, or it gives me some sense of like being able to plan what to do next. You're kind of like a chicken with its head cut off. It's kind of that kind of energy, kind of rushing and flitting about aimlessly, as if motion itself, moving is the only important thing, but like the moving doesn't really result in anything. You might kind of have this like, don't just stand there, do something kind of like attitude. And you might be high on your own adrenaline. So this is like a left brain fight, flight, chronic dissociation. Pete tells us that extreme flight types are like machines with the switch stuck in the on position. They are obsessively and compulsively driven by the belief that perfection will make them safe and lovable, whether that's perfection with your health, perfection with your money, perfection with your anxiety, with your relationship. They rush to achieve. They rush just as much as in thought as they do in action. Left brain dissociation is using constant thinking to distract yourself from underlying abandonment pain. I'm just going to think my way out of it. Basically, if I just think about this long and hard enough, if I'm just creative enough, I'll get out of it. So here's what we can do. If you identify with left brain dissociation, first and foremost, obviously always awareness. So when you become aware that you are engaging in these like flight type, super anxious, obsessive compulsive behaviors, like doom Googling, the Facebook groups, the Instagram, the researching, just noticing, oh, I'm thinking about the future right now. I'm not even present in this moment. Or because I'm thinking about the future, now I'm like going on my phone and Googling a bunch of stuff. So that's cognitive awareness, is like noticing what's happening with your thinking. And then somatic awareness is noticing, what do I feel in my body when I'm doing these things? So what do I feel in my body whenever I'm like Googling? What do I feel in my body whenever I'm researching all of these different relationship Instagram accounts to try to find out if I'm supposed to be with my partner or not? What do I feel in my body whenever I'm catastrophizing about my health and making this symptom or this thing mean something? And of course, curiosity. So we can ask ourselves, like, because this like flight state, right, is running away, right? It's like you're trying to escape by running away, or you're trying to save yourself by running away, defend yourself by running away. So even if you're not actually running, but in your head, it's like running, right? Really fast, obsessive, looping thoughts. What hurt am I running from right now? Like, what is my body trying to get me to run from? By seeking certainty or Googling or researching or finding all these Instagram accounts about finances or manifesting $10,000 in a week or, you know, whatever you think you're going to get. What is the most important priority for me in this moment? Can I stay present in this feeling for a few more moments or minutes? It's a very powerful practice, by the way, like of all of these, that third question, can I stay present in this feeling for a few more moments or minutes, is like, that goes perfectly with widening our windows of tolerance to stress and discomfort. So it's like, if your typical pattern is the anxiety comes in because you felt the symptom or whatever, and you would typically like reach for your phone to Google something, or you would typically hop on Instagram to go find that one account that you follow that, oh, she said something about this, I need to go find that video, or like whatever, the best thing that you can do instead of going into your typical adaptive behavior is to just sit there with it and just be with the symptom or the sensation for like one more minute or two more minutes if you can. Even if you still Google, even if you still go on Instagram or Facebook or whatever you do, even if you still do that, that's okay. Like, I'm not telling you that if you do the adaptive behavior that you're bad, you're not. It makes sense why you do it. But if we're trying to repattern some of these behaviors because they're not actually making our lives better, then we see, can I be in this discomfort without trying to do the certainty seeking, even if it's just for another minute? And then what sort of comfort and soothing is my inner child asking for right now? So just going back to that like 5 or 6 year old part of us, imagining that they're like Googling and researching and trying to figure out if their relationship is okay, or if their money is okay or whatever, and they're overwhelmed and they're sad. And like all of that, like really tuning into that part of you and being like, okay, little kid, like, what do you need right now? What is it that you're trying to run away from, and what do you need right now? Also, grief work. So grieving is really, really important because we have these childhood wounds and losses, and like it's important that we hold space for the fact that our parents weren't good enough, or we were emotionally abandoned or neglected. It's important for us to develop compassion and tenderness for ourselves. We can do self-compassionate crying. We can grieve for a parent who maybe was only caring and tender with us whenever we were sick. I think I like used to go to the nurse's office a lot in like fourth and fifth grade. Like probably two or three times a month, I went to the nurse's office at school because I had like an upset stomach. And now I can look back and I'm like, of course, I was anxious as fuck. Like I was so anxious as a child, but for me, it was all manifesting in my stomach. And of course, I didn't have the emotional or cognitive ability to be like, oh, right, it's because I'm growing up in this house with this like physically abusive stepfather and this mother who's giving me the silent treatment and all of that. But what I did know, what I did figure out is when I had a stomach ache, if it was bad enough, the nurse would call my mom and my mom would have to come pick me up from school. And guess what? If my mom had to come in the middle of the day and pick me up from school, then it meant she was coming to me. She was coming to rescue me or save me, to care for me. It meant she and I were the only ones home for the rest of the day before my stepdad and my brothers got home from school. So it meant I got one-on-one time with my mom where I got to experience her tenderly taking care of me. It only happened when I was sick. So my body was really smart to get sick because that's the only time I got that need met. Sorry, slowing down, slow way down, right? So this like flight sort of state of overthinking and trying to figure it out through seeking certainty. And, you know, if I just think enough about this, I can figure it out, like slowing everything down. Start to practice activities or things that you can do that require you to go at a slower pace. Start to familiarize your nervous system with slowing down. Like even if you're just walking, slow down the pace of your walking. It might make you really uncomfortable. Okay, now we'll switch over to right brain dissociation. So this is the more typical dissociation that we typically think of like checking out. So we weren't allowed to use, we couldn't fight back against our parents. We couldn't run away against our parents, and like people pleasing and fawning and all of that didn't work. So we didn't really have anything left except to just check out. So we could seek refuge in dissociated behaviors such as excessive sleeping, watching TV, scrolling online, browsing, video games, daydreaming, anything that just like captures your attention and helps you zone out, you know, drinking to passing out or something like that. May have also the symptoms of ADD. Right brain dissociators are, according to Pete Walker, they master the art of changing the internal channel when the inner experience becomes uncomfortable. So that's where you can use like alcohol or, you know, drugs or like painkillers or something like that to like change your internal experience because it has become too overwhelming. You can project perfectionism onto other people, and you can use the imperfections of others to justify your self-isolation. We can sometimes exhibit extreme detachment from reality when we're in an emotional flashback, may have very few to no positive relationship experiences, and are skeptical and scared of intimate relationships. People who dissociate in this way are less likely to seek therapeutic help. And I think it's because they just don't have the mobilization in their nervous systems to give them the energy to like seek help out. And that feels really overwhelming. They can also have really strong denial about how their adaptations have narrowed their lives. So, you know, if you're isolating, if you, you know, only like let yourself go out during certain times, you can't leave the house during the evening, you have a really rigid bedtime, a really rigid routine, like things like that, your life can get smaller and smaller and smaller, but you may like feel like you have to justify those things, or you like have to defend yourself with those things. And you're kind of denying how much these adaptations have made your life smaller. And then of course, right brain dissociators can self-medicate with, you know, alcohol, narcotics, weed, kratom, whatever. Pete says it is often the scapegoat or the most profoundly abandoned child, the lost child, who is forced to habituate to the freeze response. now allowed to successfully employ fight, flight, or fawn responses, the freeze type's defenses develop around classical or right-brain dissociation. Dissociation allows the freeze type to disconnect from experiencing his abandonment pain and protects him from risky social interactions, any of which might trigger feelings of being re-traumatized. So here's how we can help if you feel like you identify more with the right brain dissociation. This is like the most important pattern that needs a therapeutic relationship and co-regulation. So whether that's a coach or a therapist, but someone who can provide like a safe container of a relationship and someone who is familiar with the state of freeze and collapse, or if that's not possible, having like another mammal's nervous system to borrow to co-regulate with. So like your dog, your cat, something like that. Obviously, awareness, of course, is always important. So having awareness that your childhood wounding of being the most abandoned child has created this type of dissociation, or that your habits are keeping you really stuck so that you're not really moving out of that state. And it's just kind of a feedback loop that it's like, okay, the more stuck I feel, the more I need to sleep or the more I need to medicate, which numbs me out even more. So then I feel more stuck, and like, it just keeps going in a cycle. Body awareness. What am I feeling in my body? What does dissociation feel like? What does self-isolation feel like? Or what am I feeling whenever I dissociate? What am I feeling whenever I self-isolate? And then if you can mobilize your nervous system, so co-regulation can be really helpful with this, or mobilizing breathwork and other somatic tools. If you haven't watched the workshop that you got when you signed up for Feel Without Fear called Thawing the Freeze Response, that would be a really good one to watch, because there's two mobilizing practices in that workshop. These, one is a breathwork and one is a movement practice, and like both of them will mobilize your nervous system, like absolutely, but they're not going to mobilize it and make it stay that way forever. So if you're like needing to access some temporary mobilization because you need to get something done or you need to go somewhere or whatever, and you're typically like just dissociated, you know, collapsed, those practices can be really, really helpful for giving you some temporary energy to get where you need to go. But as with any nervous system state, there's always truth to that nervous system state. So if your body is collapsed and shut down to some extent, like we don't want to just do constant mobilization practices, because the wisdom of the body is saying no, rest, right? Jim Carrey says depressed is deep rest. Like if you are depressed, your body is calling for deep rest. So obviously we don't want to mobilize all the time and deny our bodies the deep rest that our body is asking for. But at some point, if doing nothing, if the deep rest isn't shifting you, like if your body isn't naturally going, oh, okay, like I've gotten some rest, I'm not feeling as overwhelmed, I'm not so burned out because I pulled back on some responsibilities, I got more sleep. Like if you're doing that for a few months and you still don't feel like you're recovering, then that's when I would encourage you to start using some mobilization practices more regularly. But it's always important that we give our bodies time to naturally shift our nervous system state on its own. And it often will. I've only experienced maybe a handful of occasions when someone's nervous system didn't naturally and organically shift into feeling a little bit more mobilized on its own. And we had to do more like breath work or movement in order to like encourage that shift to happen. But give yourself time first, especially if you've been going in a fight flight state for a long time, that period of deep rest, of shutdown, is actually necessary, because in a chronic fight flight state, you're using all of the resources of your body and like depleting your energetic resources. So that period of deep rest, even if for weeks or months, might be necessary to replenish the resources used during a chronic fight flight state. But if after a time of deep rest, you're noticing that you're still dragging, like that's what was happening to me. That's why I went and got my thyroid checked, is because I was like super burned out, overwhelmed, but not sleeping, depressed, like resting, taking so much stuff off my plate, like getting energy work done, getting massages regularly, like nourishing my body, going to bed when I needed to, like doing all the things that I know are really, really supportive of deep rest. And I was just still dragging my ass, like still not recovering from it and coming out of it. And that's when I was like, I need to go get my thyroid checked. And then sure enough, it's like, oh, this explains why I can't fucking move. So yeah, I'm doing much better now. All right, now we'll talk about disembodiment. So whether you are left brain dissociated or right brain dissociated, you're not embodied when you have any kind of health anxiety. Like, you're not in your body, you're in your head. Disembodied people are going to have some type of anxiety. And disembodied means you're not connected to your body. So I'm not talking about hyper-focus on symptoms. It's like, oh yes, I'm connected to my body. I know exactly what my body's doing. I know exactly what my body feels. I'm not talking about the hypervigilance connection. I'm talking about the connection to the wisdom of your body, to like the message that anxiety has for you, the message that the pain has for you. That's the kind of connection I'm talking about. Every client I've had with any type of anxiety, whether it was relationship, health, social, money, general, whatever, who has ever come to work with me has had one thing in common. They always hope that by working with me, the troubling sensations and symptoms they experience are going to be gotten rid of, fixed, or resolved. And they believe that if I don't have symptoms, then that means I'm healed. I actually had a Voxer message this morning from a client who we did some work yesterday with his abandoned kid on his bus. And he said he woke up this morning and he just had this like feeling. And he was like, you know, I know I've read complex PTSD and I've read nonviolent communication. And, you know, I've tried this practice that you've given me, but like, I just can't get rid of this feeling. I can't get rid of this feeling. So is there some other book or some podcast or like some other tool that you can give me that will help me get rid of this feeling? Cause I really don't want to feel this way. And like, I'll just read to you my response to him. So my response was, well, we don't get rid of feelings. We feel them. We listen to them. Often we don't need more tools or resources. You're allowed to tell your partner what hurts and what your need is. Obviously we can't meet our own needs for intimacy. That was the feeling he was having. He was like, I just feel like I'm cut off from intimacy with my partner. And like, I feel like I need intimacy and connection and I'm not getting that. So how can I meet this need for myself to get rid of this feeling? So I said, we need relationships for intimacy. I hear that you want to stop feeling this hurt, but it's a messenger. If we stop or get rid of it, that's suppression. And I'm not into that. We cannot meet all needs ourselves. If we could, we would be solo creatures, but we aren't. We are pack animals, herd animals, and we need people for safety and intimacy. Yes, we can create safety within ourselves, but no one is a lone wolf who can meet all their own needs. I'm curious, if this feeling totally disappeared, then what? You'd stop feeling uncomfortable? Notice what's underneath this urge to get rid of feeling this way and what's driving you to ask for more tools or resources or books that might have the answer for you. Okay. So he's like seeking, give me something that's going to get rid of this, right? Give me something. And this can be really tricky because it's like, you can totally justify why you don't want to feel the way you feel. So then it feels justified to want to get rid of it too, right? But you all know that you don't just get rid of how you feel. Like, there's no snapping your finger or book or anything that you can read that just gets rid of how you feel. The feeling is a messenger. It's the language that the body speaks. So we have to listen to it, not get rid of it. So no symptoms doesn't heal health anxiety. Just like having a perfect relationship doesn't heal relationship anxiety. And just like having $50,000 in your bank account might not heal money anxiety. Like, if you have a money wound of scarcity where it's like, it doesn't matter how much money I have, it's never going to be enough because inevitably something big is going to come along and I'm going to have to use all this money to pay for it. And then I'm going to be out. So therefore it's never enough. Then having more money in your bank account doesn't make that go away. You'll never feel safe or satisfied with any amount in your bank account if that's the belief you have. So just like not having a relationship anxiety or relationship doesn't heal relationship anxiety, not having money or having more than enough money doesn't heal money anxiety, and having no friends doesn't heal social anxiety. Like, you'll still experience those things even in the absence of the thing that you think is the problem. So any kind of anxiety is marked by hypervigilance, whether about your environment, other people, people's facial expressions, body language, danger, or internal sensations, hypersensitivity to light, sound, smells, other people, facial expressions, body language, perceptions, internal sensations, catastrophizing, worst case scenario thinking about belonging, behavior, what others' behavior or communication means, and what your internal sensations mean, obsessive thinking and worrying about your environment, other people, facial expressions, body language, danger, internal sensations, attempts to control and micromanage, again, about all those things, and perfectionism, again, about all of those things. So health anxiety is just like any other kind of anxiety, except health anxiety doesn't involve a relationship with another person or group or entity, such as money or a business. It occurs in relationship to one's own body. And often people with health anxiety are also very anxious, hypervigilant, and controlling of the health of their partner, their kids, or their pets. So overcoming health anxiety is not about troubleshooting symptoms or changing your diet or getting on a bunch of supplements or protocols or learning more health information or joining different Facebook support groups or following more Instagram accounts or finding a different health practitioner. None of those things are going to help you overcome health anxiety. You're probably already trying to do all of those things to not have health anxiety, and it's not working. You still have health anxiety. But overcoming health anxiety is about widening your window of tolerance to hold uncomfortable sensations, reducing your reactivity, catastrophization, and hypervigilance through creating more safety in your body. And I will add more trust with yourself. Oh, which I have at the bottom, cultivating self-trust. Whoops. Changing the energy with which you approach your healthcare. This is a huge one. And acceptance of whatever is happening. Like, I feel this weird symptom. I have this weird anxiety about my relationship. Even though I have a comfortable amount in my bank account, it still doesn't feel like enough. Like, this is what's happening. That's the quickest and easiest way I can tell you how to accept something. Just being present with what's happening and acknowledging, yep, this is what's happening. This is what's going on. Whether I like it or I don't, this is what's happening. Okay. Big question that everyone always asks with health anxiety. But what if there's really something wrong with me? What if it's not all in my head? What if I have a real health issue? Okay, it's true. There could always be something medically, physiologically wrong in your body that may require treatment, whatever that treatment looks like. Feeling sensation and symptoms and noticing the stories in our head about them doesn't mean that we can't or shouldn't seek medical care or that medical help isn't necessary. It might be. And that's okay, right? With or without health anxiety, you may actually need like medical assistance, and that's okay. The point of feeling without fear isn't to fix, get rid of, micromanage, or control sensation or symptoms. We can experience painful symptoms without fear. Like, there are a lot of people in this world who are in terrible amounts of pain and have terrible health issues, and they're not anxious about it. Like, I know that's really hard for us to believe, but they're not. My dad is one of those people. Like, my dad has emphysema, COPD. He's extremely obese. He can't even walk down my driveway and back up. Like, physically, he cannot make it down my driveway and back up. And like, he has no anxiety about his health whatsoever. Like, none. That is so foreign to me that I don't even know like how to wrap my head around that. But like, I have to hold space that there are people who have actual real health things going on and they don't have anxiety about it. So like, why is that? I wonder why they have these big, real health issues happening. And maybe I have like more minor health issues happening, you know, like COPD and hypothyroidism. Like, one is definitely worse than the other, right? So it's like, I wonder why I can have a more minor health issue happening and I am like anxious as fuck about it. But my dad has this major health issue happening and he's not anxious about it at all. It just goes to show you that your experience of anxiety is entirely subjective. Right. So feeling without fear can change the energy with which we approach our healthcare. And that's what I want to talk about next. So if we are in an unconscious energy when approaching our healthcare, we can be reactive. There's a sense of urgency. The energy is anxious. We can feel closed, resistant, being angry at our body, feeling like our body has betrayed us. But when we're conscious and approaching our health and health anxiety, we can be responsive to slow down. We can approach ourselves with a more peaceful energy. We can open instead of closing off. We can accept and surrender what's happening. And we can learn to take better care of our bodies if we need to. Because sometimes my thyroid is a great example of this. Like, sometimes the symptom is pointing to a thing that's like, hey, we need help. We need extra support here. I wouldn't have known that my body needed that extra support if I hadn't listened to my symptoms, right? And like discerned that I gave it time. I gave the rest time. I gave the energy work time. I gave it lots of time and space. I probably gave this health thing like way more time, exponentially more time than I've ever given a health thing before, because I trusted myself to figure it out and to find what was true. And so when the resting wasn't helping and the nourishing food wasn't helping and pulling back on my schedule wasn't helping and going to bed earlier wasn't helping, when none of those things were helping and the sensations are still there, then it's like, okay, my body is clearly asking for more support than what I'm currently giving her, even though I feel like I'm giving my body a lot of support. She's clearly asking for more. And sure enough, she was like, I needed some fucking thyroid hormone. And that's okay. Like, I'm happy to support my body in that way. So when we're triggered by our health symptoms or anything, we suffer because we resist. We're resisting the feeling. We're resisting the vulnerability. We're resisting setting the boundary. We're resisting spending the time with the kids, even when we have an opportunity. We're resisting saving money when we could. We're resisting whatever. Avoidance of or panic about feeling means you're going to keep fighting against your body. If you feel without fear, you're much more capable to listen to your body. Because again, all these feelings and sensations are just messengers, and we have to learn to speak the language of our bodies. When we avoid or panic about feeling, we're trying to think and fix our way out of pain, illness, discomfort. But when we feel without fear, we can settle into our body and try to create the best possible reality that we can by working with our bodies. I mean, like, maybe you do need some physical therapy. Maybe you do need some pelvic work. Maybe you do need to get your thyroid checked. Maybe you do have some liver detox issues. Like, all of those things can be true. When we avoid or panic about feeling, we are living in this panicked, anxious resistance. Like, no, even though this is happening in my body, I absolutely cannot accept it. I cannot feel that this is happening in my body. I have to do something about it. Like, there's so much energy required to be in that level of resistance. But when we feel without fear, we can live in calm acceptance of what's happening. And we don't have to be like, no. When we avoid or panic about feeling, we fight to get help or to get it fixed. We want it done as quickly as possible. We might even spend money we don't have to force that to happen. When we feel without fear, we can choose the help we seek with ease, trusting that if it's what we need, we won't have to force it or fight for it. Like, we actually can surrender to the universe and trust, like, okay, if I need help with this, then I trust that what I need will be available when I need it. And that doesn't mean that you don't find that person, right? It's not like they're just going to drop in your lap sometimes. So the hormone clinic that I'm working with in Texas, I found out about them through a referral from my psychiatrist, because I wasn't sleeping, even though I was dead ass tired. And I was like, I think I need to get my hormones checked, but I don't know of anyone where I live who does like functional hormone testing and treatment. And he was like, here, I'll refer you to this clinic. And so I did. So it was like, I just had to mention to my doctor, here's what I'm experiencing. And you know that I'm like burned out and I'm not sleeping. And I was having to use medication to sleep again, which now I'm not. Like, so the fact that I was able to share with him what was going on, and then he was able to be like, yeah, here, go get your hormones checked. Here's this functional hormone clinic. And I did. And then I got the results that I got. Like, it took 9 months of burnout to get there, pretty much. But I wasn't forcing. I wasn't like pushing my way into doctor's offices. I waited until it naturally came to me with very little seeking. When we avoid and panic about feeling, the panicking and forcing our way, we're panicking and forcing our way into the doctor, into testing, like stuff like that. When we feel without fear, there can be this like grounded sense of waiting to see if the body resolves the sensation on its own. You know, and like, that's where I felt like I was with the burnout situation. It was like, I was just in this grounded sense of like, yes, I'm uncomfortable. Yes, I'm freaking exhausted. I'm not looking forward to going to bed and not sleeping another night. Like, okay, this is what's happening. But it wasn't like, oh my God, something's wrong. I have to go get help. I have to figure this out. Like, it wasn't like that. It was just like a waiting until it was like, okay, seems like there's still something going on that requires more support than what I currently have. Getting my hormones checked seems like the natural next step. So that's what I did. It was like much more ease, much more relaxation about it. In 2019, I went to the emergency room and urgent care four separate times with really painful sensations and symptoms in my pelvis. So this was when I was like going through my dark night of the soul. This is what I was experiencing physically. My urethra spasmed for like 5 months, like I had a UTI, except I didn't have a UTI. Every time they cultured my urine, it would never show bacteria. And I even peed on those strips at home to see if I had a UTI, and I never had a UTI. And also my pelvis felt really heavy, like something was going to fall out of me. I did not have a prolapse. It was something else. And I was experiencing debilitating anxiety and insomnia about my health. I had anxiety about the anxiety. I had anxiety about the insomnia. I had fucking anxiety about everything. And I went to the ER in urgent care because I was like desperate to know what was wrong with me and why I was feeling these sensations. So for 5 months, I panicked from October, November of 2018 to March of 2019. I panicked. My mental, physical, emotional, and spiritual health declined really, really quickly. I lost so much weight in a very short amount of time. I was not eating. I was eating all the time. I was even getting up in the middle of the night and eating because I was so hungry, but it was like the more I ate, the more weight I lost. Whenever I lied down, the pain and the heavy sensation in my pelvis would resolve. And so at that time I was very new to listening to my body. And so the two and two that I put together was like, okay, if I experience the spasming and this pain and heaviness in my pelvis when I'm standing up, but I don't experience it when I'm lying down, clearly my body is asking for me to lie down and my body is asking for rest. And so then I like spent the next 5 months, like basically in bed, because the only time that my body felt somewhat better was if I was lying down. All of this was just too much. It was just too much. It was like the darkest time of my life. It's the hardest thing I've ever been through. And not only was I dealing with like the pelvic pain and the pelvic symptoms, I had this anxiety and this insomnia on top of it. And my whole life, like my full-time job basically became researching what was going on with me, calling doctors, going to the ER in urgent care, teaching myself how to read my own fucking CT scans, joining the Facebook support groups, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It was miserable. But on the plus side, I can read a CT scan now. So, but like, I shouldn't have to know how to read a CT scan, you know, but I was fighting against my body and I was desperately trying to fix my mind and my body. Like this was a rough time. It turned out that going to the ER four separate times was totally unnecessary because what was wrong with me was never going to be solved in the emergency room. What I had going on wasn't an emergency. It just seemed like an emergency because the story in my head was that something was terribly wrong and no one could figure it out. So I forced and pushed and resisted trying to get answers. And it's like, if you show up at the emergency room, you're guaranteed to get seen that day. You don't have to wait for a doctor's appointment. You don't have to wait for a referral. You're guaranteed to be seen. And I was like, God damn it. I'm going to be seen. There is something wrong with me and I have to figure it out and I have to fix it. And the only way I can be seen immediately is to go to the emergency room. It's so much more expensive to go to the emergency room than it is to just go to the doctor. Like I spent so much unnecessary money because I was so desperate to fix this thing. Okay. So what did I have going on? I had something called pelvic congestion syndrome, which is varicose veins in your pelvis. I needed a small surgery. So I now have 13 platinum coils in my pelvis because I have varicose veins like all around my uterus, my bladder, my ovaries, in the bottom of my pelvis. And if you don't know about varicose veins, it's essentially like the valves in the vein that push the blood back up to the heart. The valves in my pelvic veins had like ceased to function. So when I stood up, the veins had to work against gravity to push the blood back towards the heart. And because the valves were broken in my veins, the blood in trying to go back up to my heart was just pooling back down with gravity. And so every time blood pooled in my veins, it distended and stretched my veins even more, which created a lot of inflammation, a lot of swelling, a lot of bloating, a lot of pain, pressure, and heaviness in my pelvis. And whenever I lied down, my body wasn't working against gravity. So those symptoms were eased. Like it made sense. So in June of 2019, David and I traveled to London. There's only one vein clinic in the whole world that treats pelvic congestion syndrome the correct way. It's called the Whiteley Clinic. It's in London. It's amazing. I've been free from pelvic congestion symptoms ever since. I forget that I have these platinum coils in my body. I can still go through like the X-ray machine at the airport and like metal detectors and all that kind of stuff. I can still have MRIs and all that. And then the other thing that I had going on was pelvic floor dysfunction, and I needed pelvic floor physical therapy. So the spasming in my urethra was because I had a hypertonic pelvic floor. I know now, I didn't know then, that the end of our vagus nerve is at the cervix. So the health of our pelvis and the health of our nervous systems is like extremely connected together. And from like a lifetime of anxiety where I was like clenching and bracing a lot had created a pelvic floor that was tight but weak. So tension doesn't equal strength. Like that's like a tenet of physical therapy is like something can be tense, but it's not strong. And so I had all of this tension in my pelvic floor, but I had no strength in my pelvic floor. And the tension, the muscle, the spasming was like the muscles spasming in my pelvic floor that made it feel like a UTI. It was extremely uncomfortable. Neither one of these things were emergencies, right? I'm not going to get pelvic floor therapy at an emergency room. I'm not going to get a pelvic vein embolization in the emergency room. Like that required like special. I had to fucking travel to London. I had to go to pelvic floor physical therapy for 18 months every single week. Like neither one of them were emergencies, but the health anxiety told me they were, told me they were. The sensations were too uncomfortable, too distressing, too alarming, too anxiety inducing, and I had to figure it out and I had to fix it so that I didn't have to feel it anymore. Oh, in hindsight, I have a lot of compassion for that version of myself. She did not have very much awareness. She did not know how to exist in this body with acceptance and openness and love for whatever is happening. She did not know how to be present with discomfort and be okay. And I understand now that my decade-long obsession with health and wellness prior to this whole experience is partly responsible for my resisting feeling and my fear of sensations and symptoms. Because I was in health and wellness world for like a decade before all this happened. I'm also able to see now how I was seeking certainty and answers from sources outside of myself. So when a child is afraid, she looks to authority figures for safety, right? She looks to parents, teachers, grandparents, police, firefighters, whoever. That's who she's looking for safety. She knows she can't provide her own safety. She's not capable. This is healthy. It's healthy for her to look to adults and other authority figures she trusts for safety. The child develops self-trust when she has emotionally available parents who encourage her to listen to her own body and intuition, who don't catastrophize about her normal sicknesses or normal curiosities in play, such as climbing trees or jumping off a higher surface. She also develops self-trust when she's allowed to learn through mistakes and trial and error. I don't know about you, but I wasn't allowed to make mistakes and learn from them when I was a child. I got punished for my mistakes. So how was I supposed to develop self-trust? When she has questions, she is met with openness and love rather than shaming. I had a stepfather who, whenever I would ask a question, would literally say, "Lindsay, go back to sleep." Like, because I would just ask a question. It was like he could not be bothered, and I had to be dumb in order to ask the question. She develops self-trust as a natural response to being raised in an environment where her childish behaviors, curiosities, and questions are met with love, compassion, empathy, and safety. Trusting yourself is your natural state. But full-grown adults with unhealed inner child parts outsource their self-trust. In the absence of that self-energy to take care of them, they look outside to authority figures for answers. And now, instead of the authority figure being your parents or the police or your grandparents or the firefighters, now your outside authority that you're looking to for safety is Google and Facebook groups and Instagram accounts and health websites and doctors. It's insecure attachment playing out with your own body. Both wellness culture and conventional medicine pathologize our symptoms, which actually means they're pathologizing the sensations of our bodies, which leads to us as humans pathologizing sensation, being fearful of feeling, and disconnecting from our bodies. That's why we're fucking disembodied. So, am I saying that if you learn to feel without fear, then the sensations will subside and the symptoms will go away? No. I understand you want certainty. You want certainty that this workshop is the answer. You want certainty that if you just feel it, it'll disappear. You want certainty that you don't have to feel uncomfortable things in your body ever again. You want certainty that you're going to get your health back, and you want certainty that you won't be triggered ever again. That doesn't exist. That is a mythical creature. It's not real. You can stop looking for it. The truth is that you will get triggered again. You probably won't always have perfect health. We're all in human bodies that have to die at some point. They're going to die from something. The truth is that your symptoms might not go away at all. You might still have a condition that you need medical help for. The truth is that you're never going to stop feeling uncomfortable things as long as you are in a human body. And the truth is I don't have the answer, and no one has the answer, because there is no one right answer. So if you have been seeking certainty, whether about your finances, your relationship, your health, or anything else, you might need to grieve over the fact that you've been searching for a mythical creature. It's okay if you feel sad, mad, hopeless, helpless, weak, exhausted, upset that the certainty you think you're going to find doesn't actually exist. What do you notice in your body as you process that, as you sit with the possibility that the certainty you seek isn't real, that it doesn't exist, that you're not going to find it? Do you notice resistance? Do you notice relief? Do you notice openness, closing? So if certainty doesn't exist, then what is the point? If you can't be certain of what you want to feel certain about, then what do? You trust. You trust. The opposite of uncertainty is not certainty. The opposite of uncertainty is trust. I trust. See how you feel in your body when I read these statements. I trust that I can feel the sensations of my body and be okay. I trust that feelings and sensations aren't harmful. They're just how my body speaks and lets me know something isn't okay. I trust that I can face triggers and be okay. I trust myself to know if I will need medical care. I trust that the resources I need will be available when I need them. I trust in my body's ability to heal when I give my body what it needs. I trust myself to feel uncomfortable things. All right, let's take a quick break and then we will come back. Let's take a break until we'll say 55 after the hour. So that's about 5.5, 6 minutes. Please use the restroom, stretch, get a drink, whatever you need to do, and we'll come back in 5.5 minutes.